You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about mental health professionals who've dedicated their lives to helping others. And then what happens when they don't seek out help for themselves? In recent years, a survey by a church ministry researcher found nearly a quarter of pastors said they had personally struggled with mental illness of some kind. Are you a mental health professional? What challenges do you face? How do you balance hearing about your patient's emotional trauma with your own emotional well-being? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Jonathan Singer is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Loyola University Chicago, where he researches suicide intervention, cyberbullying, and family-based intervention. He's president of the American Association of Suicidology. Jonathan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's a real pleasure.
How can working as a mental health professional affect someone's emotional state, their emotional well-being?
Well, when we work with folks who are showing up with emotional, behavioral, cognitive problems, that they're emotionally distressed, they're dysregulated, one of our jobs is to honor that, to be present with that, to be authentic with that, and doing that means that we take that in, and so when you do that, you know, from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. or 8 p.m., you're taking in a lot of emotional distress. And this doesn't even count whatever's going on in your own life as a person, as someone in a relationship, as somebody who lives in the world that we live in. And so it's really an intense profession, and there's a lot of stuff coming at you.
Right, and a lot of stuff. I mean, you're transcribing notes, you're trying to look at therapy options. I mean, you're immersed in it. You're immersed in even every word as you look at transcriptions and take notes.
Yes, absolutely. The documentation side is an interesting piece of it because, you know, mental health professionals have to document what they do. This is both for good care as well as for, you know, liability and risk management. And sometimes the administrative demands of the job take up nearly as much time as the therapy demands. And that can weigh on somebody. Like, we didn't get into this profession because we want to do paperwork, but that in and of itself can be a stressor.
What if a mental health professional already is coping with a history of depression? Can listening to a patient's trauma trigger anything for the people in the helper professions?
So listening to somebody who's struggling with something that you went through can either be a trigger, or if you've done your work and you have support and you know your boundaries, it can be an opportunity for you to support that person with some insight that maybe somebody who hadn't gone through what they'd been through doesn't have. So most of the time, we like to say that you don't have to have experience with whatever the client is coming to you with. But if you do, and you've set up some safety and protection for yourself, then that actually can be incredibly valuable for the client.
We're talking with Jonathan Singer. He's an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Loyola University Chicago. And we're looking at the workplace setting for mental health professionals as they help their clients, their patients through emotional trauma and the impact for the mental health worker. Does your workplace talk about the signs of trauma and depression or look for suicide ideation? What strategies did you learn? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jonathan, what kind of services are available to mental health professionals on this front? Do you have different offerings for people who are in the business, so to speak?
So if you're working for a social service agency or you are a private practice therapist or you're working in a hospital, you probably have access to an EAP, an employee assistance program, just like anyone else. And one of the challenges with that is that you are seeing people who are like you. So they might be a social worker with 5 years experience out of grad school. And so getting the kind of therapy help that you need might be challenging because you feel like you're talking with your peer. And so there's nothing set up specifically for the helpers that is different from what other people get.
Does working as a mental health professional or offering pastoral counseling, does it put individuals at higher risk of depression or even suicide? Have you found any links there?
So we know that folks who go into these helping professions tend to have higher rates of report having experienced emotional, behavioral, cognitive problems at higher rates than people who go into, say, business school or architecture. And, you know, we don't know why that is. A likely explanation is that if I experienced severe anxiety or depression in high school and I went to see somebody and it really helped, that could shape my career path and say, hey, I want to do that too. Or I really loved what that social worker did. And so I want to do what the social worker was doing with me. I want to do that for someone else. It also could be that that experience before going into a degree program provide some insight into the human condition. And so doing something else doesn't quite fit. So there are these two things, right? Before going into the profession, we find that more folks experience these emotional, behavioral, cognitive problems. We find that there are higher percentages of folks that have had loved ones die by suicide, have experienced suicide ideation themselves or attempted suicide. But then we know that for some mental health professionals, there is risk for depression, anxiety, what we call secondary trauma or compassion fatigue, as well as suicide risk after entering the profession.
Oh, so that, you know, there could still be something going on after they enter the profession in terms of how they're dealing with those own thoughts in their own mind.
Yes, exactly. You know, you asked a really good question before about where do folks go when they, the helpers, where do they go when they need some help? And if you go to a therapist or two therapists and you're like, wow, this really isn't helping. They're not telling me anything I don't know. They're not talking to me in a way that's helpful. You could say, well, I'm not able to get what I need from people like me. And that could include a peer group. And I strongly encourage any mental health professional or prospective mental health professional to have a peer group that they can talk with about stuff. But if at that point you say, I can't be helped outside, then you're at increased risk for having all of these stories and the pain and the suffering that, that people are sharing with you lead to what we call compassion fatigue or secondary trauma.
We're talking with social work professor Jonathan Singer about how some mental health professionals find it hard to seek help. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll continue this in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about mental health care providers and how they find support. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Here in the U.S. and in Wisconsin in particular, suicide is on the rise, and suicide can happen to anyone. If you or someone you know is at risk, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, that number 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. Mental health professionals point to a stigma in seeking help for suicidal thoughts among people who work in the mental health community itself. So are you a counselor or a mental health advocate? How do you practice self-care in between crisis management? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Loyola University Chicago social work professor Jonathan Singer stays with us. Jonathan, as we look at rural psychiatrists, rural mental health providers in small communities, what challenges do they face with their own emotional well-being?
One of the things that we talk about is this idea of dual relationships. So if, let's say you and I are talking, we are talking on the radio right now, and then you go to see somebody for therapy and the person that you go to is me, right? Then we have a dual relationship. I was on your show and you're seeing me as a therapist, right? That there's a conflict there. Now, because I live in Chicago and you're in Wisconsin, that's not likely to happen. But if we're in a very small town and there are very few providers, right? It's more likely to have a dual relationship. And so what that means is that folks who are the providers can have an even harder time finding their own help. It can be hard for them to sort of discharge or engage in self-care in ways that might seem odd to other folks because they don't want their reputation to be influenced by what other people see. So folks in rural areas really have a challenge with some of the things that we consider to be kind of standard self-care for caregivers.
What might standard self-care look like to you?
Well, the first thing is it's really important to remember that taking care of yourself as a mental health professional is an ethical responsibility. If I am struggling and with my own mental health, it's harder for me to provide professional care to the people who are coming to see me. And it's fine for me to have my own issues, but I'm almost more responsible for taking care of that as a professional than if I'm just somebody in the general public. So for one, it's an ethical responsibility. Number two, I think some tips are to really sort of practice what we preach. A very basic one is what is your transition from work to home? Right? How do you leave the office after hearing about sexual abuse, domestic violence, eating disorders, suicide, and then you come home to your family? What is your transition between that experience and reality and the one where maybe you walk in and kids are hungry and people are arguing over dinner, or your partner is leaving the house to go to their job, right? And there's all these stressors. How do you take care of yourself in those moments? Really being able to understand what the supports are in your work environment. If you've experienced something like a suicide cluster, which I did early on in my career, where there was a suicide pact where we had eighth grade girls who had agreed to kill themselves. I worked very intensely with this group of girls for about 3 weeks. And at the end of it, I was totally burnt out. Yeah. I could hardly function. And luckily my organization said, "Hey, Jonathan, we're going to take some stuff off your plate. Tell us what you don't want to do for the next couple of weeks." And that gave me a sense of agency and control back. And I was able to jump in and say, "Thank you. I have some space to breathe, and now I can come back and do my job," right? And I also went and I spoke with somebody, right, in terms of therapy. But so these are just a couple of the many things that folks can do if they're helping professionals to help themselves.
I can imagine that a therapist might feel withdrawn if they don't have that transition time between work and other aspects of their life, that you could really go into cocoon mode.
Absolutely. You know, I I share this meme on social media, and it seems to resonate with people. It's it basically says, you know, I talk and listen all day, and so when I get home, sometimes I don't want to talk or listen, and that makes and that makes self care hard.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Especially for those that I love. So, and sometimes cocooning is what you need, right? You need to go inside yourself and breathe and sort of settle in. And that's fine. There's no reason why you shouldn't be allowed to do that. It's just figuring out how you can do that, when you can do that, and reminding yourself to do that.
We're talking with Jonathan Singer. He is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Loyola University Chicago. Are you a social worker? How do you set boundaries for yourself? How do you unwind, decompress? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Jonathan, I know you're into podcasting, and the chief spokesperson for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, she has a podcast about what it's like to be a humanitarian worker in really some of the world's really dangerous situations, where we know PTSD and anxiety are all side effects of humanitarian work. And this month, it was announced that an athletic wear company is launching a program that provides UN humanitarian workers with yoga and mindfulness training to kind of help counteract the stress and build resiliency and really acknowledge what's going on in their world. Do you see glimmers of hope through that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that you know, philanthropreneurship is can be an amazing thing, and I think that when organizations like humanitarian aid, where folks are going out there to trying to do good for others, if there's an explicit and intentional approach to making sure that the workers are being cared for, then that is only going to be helpful. Three decades ago, this woman named Sandra Bloom started what we consider today to be trauma-informed care in workplaces. And it basically says that we have to look at the ways that we provide services, provide care, so that we're doing a couple things. One, we're not re-traumatizing our clients. And two, we are making sure that we are addressing, acknowledging and addressing trauma, secondary trauma that the staff might be experiencing. And this is a huge step forward in social services and in help. And what I'll say is that the American Association of Suicidology is working with a committee for workplace suicide prevention. And as this gets developed, this project, it's going to be addressing all of these issues around suicide prevention in the workplace, which goes hand in hand with trauma-informed care, helping the helpers, and making sure that as people in the workplace are struggling, that everybody gets the help that they need.
Well, yeah, and many people provide some version of support, you know, just as a friend or a family member or a partner. What should we all bear in mind to stay healthy when we empathize with and support people in our lives?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is what are the limits of the help that you can give. If you come to me and you say, you know, Jonathan, this is what's going on, I'm like, okay, so I need to fix everything in Kate's life. That is going to be overwhelming, and it's likely to end in a mess. And so if as a friend you can say, okay, this person's really struggling, what I can do is I can be the one to listen to them, to validate their experience, and I can say, hey, look, I'm going to be here with you while we make the phone call so that you can talk to somebody else who's a professional about this. Right. And if it's for suicide risk, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline or Crisis Text Line or any of the other lifelines that are out there. If it's not about suicide risk, you can still call the crisis lines or you can call the 800 number on the back of the insurance card and say, hey, I really need to come in and talk to somebody. Right. So that can be a very contained, doable thing that somebody can help a friend with and know that they have done something invaluable for their friend without trying to fix their life.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much, Kate.
Jonathan Singer is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Loyola University Chicago and president of the American Association of Suicidology. If you or someone you know, as Jonathan said, might be contemplating suicide, need to reach out. National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is at 800-273-8255. You can text HOME to 741-741 to reach the crisis text line. Coming up, Chicago Public Schools students will miss class for a fourth day today as a teacher's strike drags on. We'll look at that teacher's strike in just a moment right after this news update here on the Ideas Network.